This is the Senate Committee on Labor Concerning Business Affairs meeting in Hearing Room B at 8 o'clock a.m. on January 28th, 1977.
First, we'd like to ask the committee if they would care to introduce a bill to request LC-1083 at the Fresh Air and State Home Builders Association. Again, it doesn't mean that we're supporting the bill. Senate objection. Hearing none, this is so ordered. This bill right here is Senate Bill 98. Witness is George Ashwell from the General Services.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm George Ashwell from General Services, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 98. Senate Bill 98, as proposed, would restore to General Services the right to advertise by circulating bids to establish bid lists rather than requiring newspaper advertisements of all bids. The current law, which was passed last legislature, requires that an advertisement be placed in a local newspaper for all formal bids, and this advertisement would have to show the date after which bids could not be received, the date of the pre-qualification statements must be filed, the character of the work to be done, the material or things to be purchased, the office or specifications can be seen, and the person designated for receipt of bids. In the past year, General Services has advertised approximately 5,000 such bids. I have been the person designated to contact. All these advertisements have generated about a half dozen phone calls asking for bids. This points out to me that if either the newspaper advertising is ineffective or else our circularizing our invitation to our bid list is very effective. And in either event, we feel that the final newspaper advertising to bid is unnecessary and in a costly thing. We estimate that we've spent around $6,000 a year on newspaper advertising. And General Services does maintain established lists, and I had slightly over 500 separate bid lists. A company that would want to bid typewriters, for instance, would be placed on a list. If a company wanted to bid canned fruits and vegetables, that would be on another list. There are some 4,500 vendors or firms that comprise the 500 bid list. And when we have a requirement to buy a commodity, we select the list where we have established the vendors to send that invitation to all those bidders. And this seems to be a very effective way of reaching all the bidders.
You use that method rather than...
We're supposed to use that method in lieu of paid formal advertising. Also, in the past, when we did have to operate under this method prior to the new statute, we sent a copy of all our bids to the General Commerce. They published those as a news item. Every bit of good coverage, and I think better coverage, in fact, than our formal paid advertising.
Any questions by members of the committee? Yes, thank you. We have no witnesses saying against. Would the committee care to take any action on this now? Yes.
I'd move that we pass this out.
Senator Wise missed the move that we passed Senate Bill 170 out with the, or 98, Senate Bill 98 with a D-PAS recommendation. All in favor, take the final that say aye as a roll call.
Senator Parsons, you think to Senator Jensen?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Wise?
Aye.
Mr. Simmons?
Aye. Yes, Senator. Next bill, Senate Bill 269, first witness is Paul Ramone, the Department of Justice.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm Chief Counsel for the Consumer Protection Division of the Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 269. But there are some modifications that probably should be made to the bill, and there are a number of people who have been working on the bill trying to make those modifications, and I would request that it probably not be brought up for a vote today. There's a number of interests that want to testify on it. There's not a number of problems with the bill as it presently exists. The bill was drafted before the President Attorney General took office, and there's one change that I'll point out right from the beginning that we want to delete if possible, and that is on page 4 of the bill, paragraph B at the very bottom, which says sales and unlawful trade practices, if you fail within 20 days of the receipt of a written notice to respond. We feel that is probably a wee bit harsh. That would be to page 4, line 32, paragraph B. We will not be supporting that paragraph. Now, what I thought I'd do today, if it's possible, to run through some of the provisions of the bill. I like to turn in housekeeping, but I have a feeling a few people here might object to that. or might be afraid of that terminology. The piece that I passed out probably illustrates the major point that we're trying to get at in this bill, and that concerns jurisdiction over loans and extensions of credit. And if I may, I'd like to read the little handout that I gave to you into the record and for the benefit of the people here. This concerns loans and extensions of credit and why we want jurisdiction. Mr. and Mrs. K came into our office, this was about a year ago. They had purchased appliances on a retail installment contract. The appliance dealer sold the contract to a finance company. The annual percentage rate on the contract was 21.20%. The contract did not include credit insurance since Mr. and Mrs. K specifically declined coverage. 14 months later, Mr. and Mrs. K needed $70 in cash. Mr. K called the finance company to request a loan. Later in the day, Mrs. K called and was told the loan was approved and come in and pick it up. The papers were already prepared when they arrived. Since the transaction was fairly complex, Mr. and Mrs. K were not very clear as to what happened during the closing of the transaction. It appears that they just signed the documents which were presented to them. Instead of the requested $70, they received $140 for no well-explained reason. The actual reason was that the finance company makes loans only in certain amounts in order to keep monthly payments at even dollar amounts. Instead of a loan for the additional amount, the outstanding balance of the retail installment contract was converted into a direct loan and added to the new loan. The full loan was covered by credit and property insurance, which they had declined, which cost $71.47, which was more than the loan amount originally requested by Mr. and Mrs. K. The remaining obligation on the retail installment contract was $479.16. The new obligation was $864, or $384.84 more than the old obligation, in order to obtain $140 cash.
What was the same as that?
Pardon me? Yeah. Instead of 22 payments of $21.78 left on the old retail installment contract, there were 24 payments of $36. The annual percentage rate had been raised from 21.20% to 30.94%. And if the full additional finance charge and that is the finance charge on the new obligation minus the remaining finance charge on the existing retail installment contract, is treated as the cost of obtaining the additional $140 cash. The annual percentage is over 90%. The process of combining an existing obligation with a new obligation is known in the trade as flipping or converting. When Mr. and Mrs. K were flipped, they also encountered the following. When the old retail installment contract was paid off, they were assessed a $25 fee for prepaying the contract. That money was additional gross profit to the finance company and was not separately stated on the new disclosure form. Mr. and Mrs. K would not know the finance company was charging a prepayment penalty unless they went back to the retail installment contract and were able to understand the prepayment clause. Number two, the new combined loan gave the finance company a security interest in all of the household goods, furniture, appliances, and personal property of all kinds and descriptions belonging to Mr. and Mrs. K. The retail installment contract had only the appliances sold under it as security. Remember, they went in to borrow $70. And three, by making the obligation into a direct loan, the finance company eliminated the right of Mr. and Mrs. K to stop paying the finance company if something went wrong with the appliances sold under the retail installment contract. If they stopped paying, they were subject to having all of their household debts to satisfy the obligation. It takes a lawyer with experience in financial matters to understand the many facets of the transaction, and we cannot fault Mr. and Mrs. K for not fully realizing its impact. They made a simple request for a small loan. The finance company presented them with a transaction which was, by any standard, financially much worse than the requested loan. Mr. and Mrs. K relied on the implied representation that they were receiving what they had requested. The finance company failed to disclose the material disadvantages and instead stood behind the truth-demanding disclosures which were required to be given. And because of the complexity of the transaction, truth-demanding disclosures, unfortunately, do not fully describe the transaction. Now, how common is the situation encountered by Mr. and Mrs. K? The Consumer Protection Division tried to find out by serving an investigative demand on the finance company for the production of records of a limited number of transactions in which the practice of flipping would likely to occur. The investigative demand was vigorously defended. Eventually, the Court of Appeals held in Hager versus Johnson that the Unlawful Trade Practices Act does not cover direct loan transactions. It should be noted, however, that during the course of our investigation, an attorney for the finance company stated that the practice was well established and widespread. The finance company felt that there could not be anything wrong with a practice used by many of its members. That's just an example of some of the things that we're trying to get at. We're not trying to go after any type of company that's engaging in any form of legit business.
Is this true that large nationwide companies, were they engaging in such practices? Or is this?
We don't know. That's the problem.
This company, in this case, a large?
This one was a fairly reputable
nationwide company.
As far as I understand right, it was. I was not in the office at the time, and I had an attorney prepare this for me. But what we were trying to find out with the investigative demand was whether or not the practice is widespread. We weren't suing anybody. We weren't even trying to get an insurance of voluntary compliance. All we were trying to do was find out how extensive the practice was. The court said we have no jurisdiction over the area. Now, the problem is that when you buy an article, a retail article, and if this practice is widespread, then it's a disadvantage to the consumer.
Let me ask you this. Is it going to banks having jurisdiction over such a practice?
I don't know. I really couldn't tell you. There is an exemption in the Act. If in the present Unlawful Trade Practices Act, Section 646.612 says that if somebody's conduct is in compliance with the orders or rules of or statute administered by a federal, state, or local government agency is exempt from coverage. So if they are in fact complying with rules promulgated by superintendent of banks or any other state agency, they would be exempt already. So even if we had jurisdiction over loan companies, it would only be if they were not complying with existing rules. Now, the problem is that's just one thing we wanted to find out about. There are other instances where there's a possibility that some kind of unlawful trade practice is going on, and we don't even have the jurisdiction to find out if in fact that is the case.
And all of it would arrive through the records.
Oh. Yes, it would. It would. Now, another thing that we're asking for in this is jurisdiction. We feel we We might already have it, but given the Hazer case, we want to make sure, and that is over rentals and leasing. We have a number of complaints come into the office about leasing property, leasing automobiles, leasing any type of personal household item. And we're what we'd like to do is ensure that we do have jurisdiction over that to investigate. A great percentage of our complaints are over leasing. And I believe that the Corporation Commissioner will testify at a later date if we have another hearing on 269 concerning possibility of real estate problems that they have and how they would support this bill if they would get at certain real estate practices. Now, what we should do now is go to the just what we want to do, what we want to incorporate within the laundry list of unlawful trade practices. And in that way, I'll come back to the definition of unconscionability, which is probably causing some people some concern. The proposed paragraph F on page 4 of Senate Bill 269 says that it would be an unlawful trade practice if somebody employs any unconscionable tactic in connection with the sale, rental, or other disposition of real estate goods or services, or in the collection or enforcement of an obligation. Now, if you go back to page 2 and 3, the bottom of page 2 and page 3, we define unconscionable tactics. Let me tell you right now, in the Uniform Commercial Code in Oregon, 72.3020, an unconscionable contract or a clause of the contract can be voided by a court. So we're not giving anybody any other remedy to get out of a contract. All we're saying is that if somebody is engaging in a scheme or a long practice of putting these types of clauses in, they're unconscionable. Engaging in unconscionable practices, that we want to have the ability to go in and get a voluntary assurance against them, and if they refuse to stop it, to enjoin them from doing so.
You're going to bring amendments to this bill then?
Yes, I will bring amendments to the bill. What unconscionable is not defined in the Uniform Commercial Code. What we are trying to do is limit it to give businessmen some form of standard to go by. Now, admittedly, A, B, and C sound very broad. However, there is approximately 20 or so definitions of unconscionability that have been used by various courts. And we figure by limiting them down to these three that we at least give people some standards to go by. Now, if you want to turn back to page 4 again, paragraph 2 is makes false or misleading representations of facts concerning the offering price of or the person's cost for real estate goods or services. We do an awful lot with advertised pricing. Somebody advertises a price that really is not the true and accurate price. We might already have jurisdiction over this area, but it is somewhat questionable and we want to ensure that we do have jurisdiction. That, again, is a very, very large part of our business. That is, people advertising things that just really aren't true, and we want to be able to prevent them from engaging in that practice.
Question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
You say people say things that aren't true. What about puffing? You're not going to try and eliminate that, are you?
If you want, can you define puffing? You mean just sort of talking great about their particular item?
Yeah, it's the kind of thing you hear in advertising that's obviously not true. We all know it's not true. And like the credit card stuff and all that stuff.
That is not what we go after. What I'm talking about is the price for this article is $200 when, in fact, you get into the store, the price is
$400.
All right. Okay. Well,
ready.
Could this in T also include the true cost? Does it include the financing cost? Or is that already covered?
Well, truth and lending generally will get at that in terms of financing cost.
But does that also, that doesn't cover the rent and true cost, though. If there's a deposit and the total...
In renting something?
In renting, leasing, and so forth, and the things which
right, then,
also
yeah.
involve the other costs, such as the cost of transaction, the prepayment, or the late charges for a rental.
Well, Senator, basically what we're trying to get at here is if somebody makes a representation that either the article costs them so much and they are giving you it for this great price, or that you're this is what you're going to have to pay, and they use that just to get you into the store, when in fact you'll have to pay considerably more for that. That's the type of practice we're going after.
Mr. Chairman, one other question. Thank you. Before we get too far into things on page 4, on page 3, A,
that says take advantage of a customer's physical infirmity, ignorance, illiteracy, or inability to understand the language of the agreement. Do you feel that that's language which will allow a clear definition of the taking advantage and in those circumstances really means? If I were a businessman, I would be a little uneasy about how that was going to be defined, since it requires the judgment of the businessman and using it as a convenient term, judgment of his judgment on whether or not the person understands the agreement. Are there going to be some reasonable guidelines so that people can safeguard against someone later saying, I should not understand the language of the agreement because I'm not as bad as I look?
We discussed about that this morning, and one of the things that we talked about is putting the word knowingly in there, so that if the seller knowingly takes advantage of some kind of infirmity, that was one way to get at the problem. I understand the problem that you're getting at. The problem with unconscionability itself is that the term is very broad, and the courts have attempted to define the term down. It's very hard to define. It is a catch-all. What we are trying to do here is give the court just some guidelines to go on. These are not hard and fast. Like, you have to fit within this particular thing.
As someone who's worked with the retarded, I think that one of the real difficulties that you get into is the fact that I can recall instances where individuals who really had difficulty with these sort of things would get themselves in the most fantastic situation in terms of obligations, and at first glance, you might assume that in every instance they were simply being taken advantage of. But we also, I think, forget that many people don't recognize that when someone kind of nods and disagrees, that individual may in fact not understand at all what's been discussed. And I had people when I was a caseworker calling me up and saying, I told him that he had to say such and such. I told him, what's the matter with this person? I said, well, you may not know, but their IQ is quite low, and they really don't understand these things. Or in another instance, the person might come across as intelligent and capable of entering into a transaction, but in fact they have this incredible memory problem, and where they would have difficulty getting home without guidance in these situations, and yet they could present themselves, for example, in a store, and come across quite well.
As far as the committee is concerned, we're listening to testimony, and we've got quite a few bills to go through here.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, that is a really difficult area, and I thought you pointed out.
Now, I agree with you, and I think the word knowingly in there would go a long way towards solving a lot of problems.
Do you have
a
question?
Paul, on that same question, is there any chance at this time attempt to protect the consumer would backfire in the sense that you will, since there is a penalty attached to the unfair trade practices act, that we'll get a situation where, if let's say a lower income, illiterate person comes in and tries to finance something, that the company will just feel it's not worth it because they're liable to get involved in litigation under the contract, and therefore we'll get a situation where, there simply won't be credit extended to these types of people, these lower income minority, perhaps a little segment of our society, and they'll have extremely difficult time getting credit extended, even if they knew it and it would be capable of repaying it.
Richard, the problem is this. You can already, if somebody engages in an unconscionable act or has an unconscionable clause in a contract, you can already void the contract. What we're trying to do here, and perhaps we should reword this, to say that if you can already do that, and somebody is engaging in a continuing practice of doing that to every person who walks in the door, you want to be able to stop it, so that a person isn't just going after it individually by individually. You can stop the practice itself. We're not attempting to get a lot of new jurisdiction.
Okay.
Any further remarks you have to make? There's one other section that I might point out, paragraph U on page 4. Concurrent with tender or delivery of any real estate goods or services, fails to disclose any known or readily ascertainable defect or material nonconformity. This is basically for the used car salesman who sells a car and that doesn't have an engine. An absurd example. Although not so absurd with some of the stuff we run into. I would never buy one, Senator. You would never buy one, but there are people out there who have bought those, and we get them in our office. It also covers other areas, for instance, home sales. The seller does not or knows about something that is materially wrong with the house that will substantially affect the house, and they sell the house. They are required to disclose it. The thing is, though, that they're required to disclose that now. If I buy a house or a car and there is something materially wrong so that I can't use that in the way that I intend to, I can get out of that contract. What we're trying to do is say, if that's the case and somebody engages in that over a long period of time, or in a scheme involves more than one or two people, we want to be able to stop that practice.
Well, I can see you're thinking as far as a new house is concerned. But an old house, I would think if I were buying an old house, I would look over quite well. But on a new house, it would seem more than apply. A person who's going to buy an old house would just take a good look, and there's going to be things wrong with it. I bought some old houses, there's plenty wrong with it, and it fixed them up.
The example is that is commonly given is that I go in to buy an old house. The seller has the day before received a termite inspection report that says that the place is rotting away and will last about a year. And otherwise it looks fine, but the structure is just about ready to crumble. That's a material defect in that house. And somebody ought to tell the buyer that that house is not going to stand very long.
The buyer, anyone who is going to buy a house would be looking for something like that in an old house, really.
Well, it happens all the time.
We can't lead the public entirely by the hand. And Senator Roberts.
You say that right now there are remedies for an individual who is purchasing a particular
rescission remedies to get out of the contract.
I did receive a call from an individual who purchased a house in Portland. And subsequent to the purchase, some months later, it about dropped to the floor in the bathroom because it was dry rot. And it had been covered up with newspapers and kind of, a lot of material placed over the floor so that it wasn't apparent. And the date on the newspapers indicated that it was before the sale. And it was during the occupancy of the previous owner. Other things happened as well. She contacted a real estate agent who informed her that he had no knowledge of this because he had simply looked at the house in order to evaluate this. And he didn't think to look under the linoleum in the kitchen linoleum in the bathroom, which was, I think, loosely laid. And indicated that the person who sold the house was off somewhere else now, and she did contact, I believe, the real estate commissioner, and did not seem to receive any kind of help on this. Now, what is the way to limit that? Does this bill speak to that at all? Or?
Well, this bill does give a private right of action for failure to disclose if that section is passed. There is already a private right of action in the bill. But aside from that, if I were that buyer, I would attempt to find the seller, wherever the seller was, and at least sue for damages, if not rescission.
But in your opinion, is that opportunity presently available about this?
To rescind the contract, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, there was.
You mentioned this remedy of rescission. Isn't it true that rescission is not a simple thing? And that the burden of proof is on the the buyer, and that that you can waive your right to rescission if you don't act speedily. So if you happen to be ill or something at the time you find the defect, or are uninformed as to the law, and don't get to a lawyer right away, that you may have trouble proving that you acted promptly enough to get your remedy. And this isn't an automatic kind of thing that the person is going to always be able to use.
The problem you run into is that sometimes you can attempt to rescind the contract. In your dealings with the seller, you might engage in conduct which actually means that you're trying to enforce the contract, but just get damages, and therefore your right of rescission evaporates. But what we're trying to say here is that we're not going after something that's really new. You already have certain rights. You have rights to rescind the contract. What we're trying to do is say, if somebody is engaging in a scheme, a fraud, running around buying dilapidated housing and reselling the stuff, knowing about certain defects in the housing and not disclosing those defects, that we can put a stop to that. We're not trying to give anything, any radically new remedy.
Anything further? No further questions. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Next, we have Tom Donahue, the airline.
Yes. If they didn't come in with this one amendment, wouldn't we be just as well off to wait and see those? Because it seems to me that we might be just as well off.
Tom wants to find out what the amendments are going to be, and he's indicated what the amendments are going to be. So I don't know if Mr. Donica will be opposed to it with the proposed amendments that
Wally
Lane has alluded to.
Our concern truly with the bill, and we're willing to work with the Attorney General on this, things change over time because we have not always been a supporter of this particular act. But as there's been a rising need to satisfy consumers, we have found that this bill probably is a better way to approach the problem. This law has been a better way to approach the problem, and the penchant that the legislature had to use what I call a shutdown, a specific act which the people that it was designed to get never got caught by it, and only the unwary got caught by it, or the blanket which went over the whole business community and caused the good and the bad to have to struggle together to find an answer to imposed upon by the legislature. This really is an attempt to set a standard of conduct which the retail merchants should be able to understand and abide by. Talking in with the retailers this morning. And Paul touched on it at the end. The other side of it, as you begin to add more things, and particularly vague things like the term unconscionable, as we see it, because that definition will override any court cases that now exist in the state of Oregon. You must remember that there is a private right of action, which gives you a minimum of $200, or actual damage, whichever is the greater, plus attorney's fees, and the court may in addition award punitive damages. And that's a fairly substantial private right. And well, the Attorney General, and I understand what he's saying, and you may well agree that what he wants to do and the way he would handle it would be perfectly all right. We are faced in the business community with a rising request by supposedly aggrieved customers to use this private right. And when you look at it square in the face, even though it may be frivolous, it's very difficult on many occasions not just to pay it and get rid of it. And that almost becomes blackmail. And so as we approach this, and this is all I want to say first, we would like to work with the Attorney General to see if there isn't some balancing act that can be worked out here to allow him to proceed on behalf of the people of the state of Oregon to put some kind of restraint on the private act.
So, Mr. Donovan, if you want to work with the Attorney General, I found that Jim Redden would always be willing to talk to you, and if you had care to go over and discuss this bill with him or try and take a look at the amendments, I'm sure it would be.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Are we going to have a witness here that represents the, or does this witness represent?
Well, there's one more witness to deal with it, Consumer Credit Association, for you.
Well, then my question is probably for this witness.
Okay.
It's about one of the provisions of the
airline.
The one that's just leaving.
Do you want to ask Mr. Donahue the airline question?
Yes. If somebody isn't going to be here from the athletic clubs and the paper generators. There's a provision here that says permits the customer to enter into a transaction, page 3, permits the assessor to enter into a transaction with knowledge that there is no reasonable probability of the payment of the attendant financial obligation in full by the customer. Would the so-called paper-generating institutions like your athletic clubs, I can't think of the names of them right at the moment, that
the
health clubs, the physical fitness and health clubs, yes, would they see this provision as applying to them? They're known in the credit collection business as being paper generators, as I understand it. Well, people come in who are overweight and they're on a 2-week binge of getting back into shape and losing weight, and they sign a contract that's going to last over a period of a year or longer with set monthly payments, and after a week they find that it's actually hard work to lift weights and work out, and they quit coming, and then they turn over to a collection agency and they're sued, and they eventually come into the defense of, gosh, these guys knew that I was never going to carry through with this, because they have an experience of a high percentage of people not carrying through with it, and they're having to sue to collect on these. And I'm wondering if this provision is going to fall on those people or not.
Senator, I can't respond to the question because we have none of those people within our membership. We have some problems in an ordinary retail transaction with that language.
We have overweight people in your
membership. I bet some of
Well, you answered my question, I think, because I think that these people do have representation in the legislature, and I'm sure they'll be here if something gets affected.
Mr. McKeon?
I'm John McKeon. I'm the secretary of a trade association known as Retail Trade Association of Portland. It's a trade association representing people who are in the consumer credit field. It has no collection or credit reporting function. And I'm here also to represent the Consumer Credit Association of Oregon, which embraces the same responsibilities on a statewide basis. Amy Roberts said, who's going to speak for me, in Maine, I think that our people would indeed feel that they were facing quite a serious responsibility, and especially the degree of confirmation on the part of the person who was entering into a contract. And I think this would go farther than people who are handicapped or and that sort of thing. I think we're almost getting into an area there that might better be handled through guardianship and confidence and things like that, and maybe this needs some attention. But just the wide gray area of people who certainly are never going to admit that they understand the contract. And just to illustrate that, I want to tell you what we're going to be faced with.
I would say that a great percentage of the people don't understand the contract.
But admitting it is something else again. There's federal law, Equal Credit Opportunity, which requires trade advantage to state upon an adverse decision the reason for the decision. And the basis of this is that the government trusts merchants and feels that in every case they must be discriminating unless they have an obligatory alibi that they are not discriminating, so they must state why they declined the person. And I think you can imagine the person's reaction being receiving a letter, which he must receive, saying, we are defining you because of your inability to comprehend the contract, or because of your ignorance. You feel me? I think that merchant could get very little cooperation from the customer in determining his incompetence or ignorance. It would be very distasteful to a person to be told that that was the reason for rejecting him. But let me tell you, and I should have pointed out that that's certainly unconscionable feeling such as have been described certainly would be considered reprehensible by all reputable business people. In fact, they would be rather lucky to see good business devoted to the unscrupulous in that manner. There are a few other faults I can see.
Well, the Consumer Credit Association, that's a collection agency?
No collection fund.
Who do you represent then? What do they do?
Well,
do you represent savings alone?
Yes. Retail Credit Association has about 1,000 members in there.
Small loan companies?
They would be.
Small loan companies, you don't uphold it.
Absolutely not.
Then why don't you do something with your own industry? That's what you represent. Instead of allowing this sort of thing to happen, can't you police your own industry? If your association and censor, as I have been,
The small loan companies are governed by
this is something that I need to feel
It is dreadful, I agree. And I think that the vast majority of people in the student association would agree with that sort of action. Anybody going into this dispute, and
it would be unfairly. Something like this hurts your entire industry, and it seems to me that the industry would have to set the side, and you as a leader in your industry would want to help clear up.
And I'd like
to stop that process even half years and among your own people that's in contact with. They'd be punished in some way.
I'd like to go farther than that.
Maybe that's nothing you can do. Maybe we have to talk a lot of this, but.
I'd like to go farther than that and say that in addition to censoring them, I'd be very worried. I think that we are more effective in that is to provide a penalty for unconscionable contracts to the same degree that you would send like you here. And
I don't think we would be able to enforce it.
I don't think we would be able to enforce it. I think we could enforce it directly. Instead. I think that unconscionable contracts should have the same sort of penalties that usually it does. And I think it's maybe an initiative that is responsible for somebody else beside ourselves.
Have you ever sent out letters to your association in this regard and warning not to engage in such practices to your people?
We try to.
Our meeting to bring this up.
Yes, indeed. We at one of our very last meetings, we had an attorney address us and talk about some of the unconscionable things that have been done in the past and recommending against practices which were common in the past. And we feel that our letterhead bears the motto, a trade association dedicated to a better use and understanding of the state, and we try to cover that too. However, I think we're getting into an area that is better vulnerable legislation than by
you're admitting that there is legislation needed to correct these practices.
Not in the way this is being done. I think that
there is
most of it is very good, but I think that unconscionable contracts are better dealt with by penalty than by the method that's described here.
Yeah.
There are a few things which I think that normally, I don't believe it's going to relieve the difficulty that the merchant's going to have, because what's following there on line 8 is, the provision that a willful violation occurs when a person committing a violation, New York should have known that his conduct was a violation. And I think that requiring the merchant to have knowledge which he might have, if he were lucky and happened to get that information, that is fine. But I think that it's a responsibility which shouldn't be placed upon. There are a few things, and I know that you have many important things to do with this burden system. I think that knowingly committing a customer to enter for a transaction from which the customer will derive no material benefit, that's on line 3. That's what we've been speaking about. Would seem to touch on accommodation endorsement. I think people do endorse loans of others and receive no material benefit from them. And that, I think, would be good trouble.
John, could I make a suggestion? If you have suggestions on changes that bill, obviously, they're going to offer some amendments to us. Paul Romaine is in the Portland office. Why don't you get together with him and try and come up with something that's acceptable for both the industry and that will correct such practices as we
thank you for that too, and thank you for
it. And Paul is in the, and I think we can contact Paul in the Portland office, and that is true, it's also with Tom.
Could I ask a question?
You want to ask a question here, Mr. McKeon. Tell your words.
Mr. McKeon, on the last page of Mr. Romaine's testimony, he said that in a finance company, Tony said this practice was widespread, well-established and widespread. You haven't responded to that statement. Do you have a response?
I have not investigated the extent of it, and I don't know. I think that...
Do you represent finance companies?
Yes. Well, the word represent isn't quite the thing. We have those who support our organization, finance companies, but I'm speaking to you here. I suppose to that degree, I am speaking for them.
And you don't know whether this is
undoubtedly, this alteration of the relationship from a contract to a loan goes on. But to the degree of this reprehensible manner, which was changes just up to that extent, and these figures, I would say that without an investigation, I think that it would be rare. that.
But you don't know.
Actually, for that degree, I mean, this is, we're talking about another degree. There is when a transaction is changed, maybe the terms are changed, but the degree, this degree is something else. Well, there are rules in the, that are enforced, and the arrangements which govern finance companies in the state of Oregon as to the rates of charges which may be made.
So you mentioned unconscionability. Do you know if this interest rate violates the unconscionability law in Oregon?
In Oregon, we have the graduated rates which are allowed, and the commission is subject to inspection as to their conformity with those rates.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to go into that case to see if there was a violation in that case, and there is.
It's not clear to you that it is a violation of the usury rate. Would that be fair to say?
Well, it sounds like it. There's figures.
It sounds like it in terms of usury, in terms of the definition of usury being something that shocks the conscience, or it sounds like it in terms of your knowledge of the law and origin?
Well, unconscionable is...
No, not unconscionable. Usury. You were mentioning usury in your testimony.
On what I heard, I can't, I'm not rapid enough in computing to know what rates were employed there, but...
But from your knowledge of usury that exists in Oregon now, it's not obvious to you that this 90% interest rate is a violation of that, is it?
It would sound to be, but I think that the state body that governs finance companies should bestow this sort of thing and put this company out of business if they are violating.
Mm-hmm.
Efficiently, the very definite and the best rules there are on percentages, which is a proper for finance license finance companies to charge.
If you're not real sure this is a violation of usury laws, are you?
I don't know enough about that case to know.
100% rate, thank you.
It seems to me that putting Marion in the bill, so it says Marion takes advantage, is actually an amendment which the organization should be able to live with. In fact, I believe that it's true that Marion is something that's very difficult to prove, and that in fact, if you want to protect both the seller and the buyer, or two parties to a transaction, that we are going to have to amend it in such a way as to have Marion and also have some way of adding sort of Marion in that way as well. And to speak to that, I think it's clear that there are some situations where if you interpret Marion strictly, you're going to have an insight into that person's, into the seller's mind, practically. You're actually going to have evidence in terms of that person's own emotion one way or another that they knowingly
Paul Romaine is indicating he's going to submit a new amendment to that part.
Well, I'm talking to the witnesses team, and it would seem to me that the organization could support something that clarified that. Protected the consumer, am I right in that assumption?
Well, you have to accept that further on. The statute would state that the seller should have known. And then you get into, I think, a rather vague and indefinite area.
But that should have known the law, whether or not the customer understood it, isn't that correct?
Should have known what he was committing was a violation.
Mm-hmm.
And that would embrace, I should think, the fact. Out of the case. And not just the law, but facts as well.
And you mentioned the co-signing of the loan. I think that's an excellent point. I think that could be amended, however, to cover that.
Yes, I think it should.
Which is except when the customer is co-signing in a transaction whereby another party to a benefit. Would that take care of the objection?
Yes, I think it's an objection. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. That will conclude the hearing on 259. Our next bill will be heard is Senate Bill 309. John Wolf, the Department of Labor. John, maybe we could go through all three of those. Why don't we? Do you want to bring the... I can't. Oh, okay. You're not hearing all three of those, right?
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We have three bills before you today. The first is Senate Bill 309. We have registered an exemption from the exclusive remedy provision of the Workers' Compensation Statute provided in ORS 656-018. Addition of subsection 5 at lines 30 to 32 of the printed bill would make clear that the exemptions do not apply where discrimination issues are before the Commissioner of Labor and the basis of action is embodied in ORS 659. For example, a person compensated for lost time at compensation rates will not be precluded from an additional remedy if the accident could be shown to have occurred because of the race, color, sex, etc., of the complaining party. As the committee is aware, any remedy under ORS 659 by the Commissioner of Labor subsequent to public hearing is reviewable by the Oregon Court of Appeals and the Oregon Supreme Court. The measure is strictly drawn to avoid any arguability as to the separate legislative intent under ORS 656 and 659. There's no fiscal impact of this measure. An example from an actual case will help illustrate the problem. Complainant, a young black woman retired by a state agency, into a job requiring 7 months training. During her training and thereafter when she assumed a full workload, she alleged that she was subjected to various kinds of harassment because of her race. After some time, the harassment became unbearable and she sought psychiatric care. On the advice of her psychiatrist, complainant took a leave of absence. She filed for workers' compensation benefits, believing that she had been incurred a job-related injury. The Workers' Compensation Board awarded her $6,000. She attempted to return to work after seven months medical leave, but as conditions had not changed by the place of employment, she resigned and filed a complaint with the Civil Rights Division of the Bureau of Labor. Cause was found to believe that the complainant had been discriminated against because of her race. Consideration was then attempted. And because of the particularly aggravated circumstances of the case, the Bureau of Labor assessed general damages for pain, suffering, and humiliation at $15,000 and back pay damages at $12,000. At the initial consideration meeting, the attorney representing the state questioned our ability to proceed. He argued that the exclusive remedy provision of the Workers' Compensation Statute and a recent case concerning that provision, Baker v. Bazaar Incorporated, 2775-OI-245-1976, before the Supreme Court, clearly limits a person to seeking Workers' Compensation remedies in most cases. The Supreme Court of the State of Oregon has consistently adhered to a strict construction of the statutory exemption. As the situation now stands, the Civil Rights Division may have no means to remedy unlawful employment practices in such situations cited above. We urge the Legislative Assembly to correct this situation.
Are there any questions in regards? Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, are there other examples of what goes on?
This is the first case of this kind that has come to our attention. This is the first time that, in the course of consideration, the attorney has brought this. Raise this argument as a defense. At this time, this case is still pending consideration. The attorney for the respondent has served notice that should the case go to hearing or on to the appeals courts and higher courts, then that argument would be used as a defense, one of the arguments. At the moment, they are still trying to consider the case. This is the first time, this is, to my knowledge, that this has occurred. And we're not likely to get a lot of cases where injuries are directly result of some other type of unlawful discrimination. But it's clear now that we will get some cases. And last year, in 1976, we had 181 injured workers' compensation cases. And as these cases become more prevalent, as the employment situation expands to include more minorities and certain types of jobs that may be more readily injurable, then we may run into additional problems.
Do you think it's appropriate that the individual has two sources of remedy parallel going at the same time as they did in this case?
What we want to address is the unlawful employment practice, the actual discrimination, and the remedy of the discrimination. We do not want to become involved in the resolution of the question as to whether it's a job-related injury or not. Civil Rights Division practice, so using this specific example, the Civil Rights Division said $12,000 in back pay. But if the complainant in this case had received already $6,000 from the Workers' Comp Board, then our general practice is to reduce the back pay owed by the amount that the complainant had already received. So we're not trying to establish double damages. We're trying to address this, the unlawful employment practice directly. And we do not, of course, just take it back on to appeal. We just do not know how the court might rule on this. It is possible that the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court might uphold our position, but we do not know at this time.
Let me ask you this. If there were a claim against workman's comp, evidently before they paid the claim, they would have to indicate or know that there was a great deal of harassment as far as this black lady was concerned. Is that right? I mean,
that was probably
satisfied.
Yes.
That's the first claim I've heard of that.
Yes. I'm kind of interested. Was the harassment done by the employer or the fellow employee?
I do not have not reviewed the case file. The case itself is still pretty much confidential. I don't think I can reveal the state agency at this time. But it was, I think, both employer and employee.
You think?
I believe so. As the facility explained to me, it was a very bad situation.
What type of employer was it?
All I know is that it is a state agency. I do not try to get into the case file.
And it was not something that could be covered under where the injury is approximately caused by willful and provoked aggression by the person otherwise exempt under the subject. And that was considered insufficient.
Right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
Senator Weiss. There's legislation going to be introduced, or that's been introduced, to do with gay rights. And I would like to have your reaction if that legislation passed. How do you think that would affect an example like the one you just gave if you substituted the word gay or for the word black throughout that fact situation? And
it didn't change the situation at all. It could be sex discrimination too that could cause psychological damage or age discrimination. It wouldn't change our position. I don't think it would. It only be a different type of discrimination, but it wouldn't change our approach to the case. Considering that the legislation offered
yes, that's
provided for the same type of civil rights remedy that we have for these other matters.
Any further questions? Well, you want to go on to the
This is Senate Bill 310. The Bureau of Labor presently interprets the language of ORS 659-415, stating the reinstatement rights of injured workers to a former position that is available and suitable if they can perform. The Civil Rights Division interprets this to intend that this would include the same or similar positions which the employee is qualified. At the present, the employer could argue that former position is merely intended as the exact position, so that a job at machine number 3 doing the same work is not the former position, although this is the same work as an available and suitable position at machine number 4. The proposed change from the language former position to same or similar would avoid the arguability of the present language. The Bureau of Labor has read the legislative intent of the 1973 Act to be that persons not lose their livelihood because of industrial accidents, presumably involuntary to them, but at the same time that no bumping rights be applied when the job has been refilled. This language would clarify the intent by abrogating technical defenses on whether the available and suitable work for the exact form of position. We also believe that the new wording provides greater flexibility to the employer when an injured worker seeks reemployment, in addition to expediting the return of an injured worker to the productive workforce.
Any questions?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Did you decide the word similar would be better and easily definable instead of something like equivalent position?
Yes. Yes. I had conversations with both members of the civil rights staff as well as legal counsel provided by the Department of Justice. And we thought same or similar, specifically turning to same and from Black's Law Dictionary, the word same does not always mean identical, not different or other. Frequently means of the kind or species. And so we decided to go with that wording rather than equivalent.
And similar?
The same. It's interesting that similar in conventional language would appear to cover more options, but actually from Black's Law Dictionary, they because some of that can often sometimes mean exactly alike.
That's
right.
That's
right.
I understand to say that it would be against the law for him to bump someone coming back to work. The employer could not allow a bumping situation.
In this particular situation, the idea is that we want to protect the employment rights of everybody.
What if you have one employee business and a lot of members of the
In that situation, it is likely that until a position is available, then that worker is going to have to continue compensation, or there's going to have to be some other arrangement made with the employer. I don't know how many situations there are like that.
Do you continue compensation even though he was able to go back to work?
I do not know. I honestly do not know. If you like, I'd like to know. Raise the question at legal counsel and civil rights people.
I'd like to see that, sir.
Okay. Any further questions? Then we'll have another witness, but I'd like to take the third one here, too.
Okay.
311.
This here is with raise withholding for deductions. First change is on line 8 of the current bill, number OR652610. The statute currently provides employers of 5 or more employees provide their employees with a statement of deductions made from their paycheck. Employers of 1 or more employees who are subject to the minimum wage law must provide such a statement, pursuant to OR652045, subsection 3. This means that the employers of less than 5 employees not covered by the minimum wage law need not supply a statement of deductions. The purpose of the statute is full disclosure to an employer. This purpose is not now being met. Since some employers are not legally required to supply such a statement, some of the employees exempt from the minimum wage law at this time are certain agricultural workers, domestic employees, executives, administrative persons, professionals, and outside sales persons, taxi cab operators, students working for the educational institution which they attend. Deduction statements are important to some of these people. For example, taxi cab drivers and outside salespersons are typically paid commissions. Agricultural workers, domestic employees, and students typically earn room and or board as part of their compensation. Such statements would be important in these cases since they permit the employer to accurately the amount and type of deductions being made. The Bureau of Labor would benefit by this amendment because it would provide an employer with a record of his wages and deductions therefrom. At times, such statements are the only evidence an employer or an employee may have to prove their case in a wage dispute. The proposal would help the Bureau of Labor in its enforcement responsibility since many wage claims filed with the Bureau of Labor involve employers of less than 5 employees and no violations of the minimum wage law. A wage now division approximates that 20-25% of such cases. Lines 17 through 32 of the printed bill provide guidelines for deductions, incorporate parts of OR652410 in the new subsection 4, and then repeal 652410. The Bureau of Labor believes that the proposed amendment should be a benefit to the employers as well as employees. There is a benefit to employers by clearly setting out the deductions which may be taken. Although the current statute, 652410, deals with deductions relating to employee benefits, we do not feel it goes far enough and that it does not deal with other legal deductions which may be taken from wages. The proposed bill not only deals with employee benefit plans, but also with deductions required by state or federal law and employee-authorized deductions such as dues, checkoffs, charitable contributions, or other lawful purpose accruing to the benefit of the employee. The bill would be a benefit to the employee by allowing the employee some control over what can be deducted from wages. As set out in the proposed statute, the employee's authorization is necessary in certain instances, as discussed above. The proposed bill would also be a benefit to the Bureau of Labor. Approximately 23% of all wage claims worked by the Bureau each year involve illegal deductions. The Bureau processes information, by the way, about 5,500 claims a year, and about 1,265 of those involve illegal deductions. Hopefully, the amendment will cut down on the number of these claims to employer awareness. And I might add, I think the legislative assembly will be made aware when you examine our budget later in the session, That the Bureau of Labor has instituted a new employer assistance, technical assistance program. We're getting out into the field, working with employers. I think we've been well received. The preventative type of program to prevent violations before they occur, because we do find that a great deal of violations are a result of lack of awareness of the law. So hopefully this amendment incorporated has brought into our employer assistance program will help reduce the number of cases we have on illegal abductions. We also believe that the disposition of claims will be less time consuming because we now have the specific statutory guidelines that we can follow on deductions.
Okay. Good question. What about pension profit sharing? I don't have available 652.410. Where does that fit in here?
That would be a considered a legal deduction.
What's legal and what's illegal?
We're talking about a benefit with the crew to the employee.
I'm not making myself clear. Excuse me. What I'm saying is, let's suppose you have a benefit, a pension or a profit sharing program, and let's the employee makes a contribution.
Right.
If I read the language, all deductions are prohibited except those that qualify under this language. And what I need some help on is where you're saying it comes under C,
right,
line 23 and 24.
Right. Okay. I know as a state employee, when I am made aware of my deductions, and I do have to sign in a paper when I am become eligible, when they start taking retirement pay out of my check, I am made aware of that.
Have you discovered that the employer is allowing other deductions that doesn't create a benefit or not required by law? Go ahead, give an example.
A good example that happens very often would be in businesses such as a gas station, where a variety of people have access to the cash register throughout the day, various shifts. Sometimes there are cash shortages from the cash register, and often employers will deduct those shortages from an employee's check. Presently, the way we enforce this particular statute is we do not allow such a deduction unless the employee signs in and signs out with the employer, and unless that employee is the only employee who would have access to the cash register at that time. That is not always the case. Another example would be, let's say, in the construction industry, where an employee is given a company pickup and drives 100-150 miles, maybe look at a proposed project for bidding, or maybe to actually work on a project. And when the employer gets back to home base, the employer notices that more gas was used than would normally be used on such a trip. The employer then assumes that the employee used the truck for private purposes and deducts from the wages. Our process is then to hopefully to inform employers that they should not deduct from the wages, but if they see situations of gross negligence or think they have been ripped off in one way or another, to pay the wages, and then, as provided in subsection 4, they can have a cause of action against that employee. They could go to small claims court or take some other action to regain whatever loss they think they had. So these are the types of situations we run into.
It's difficult for a small businessman, especially a service station operator that's living in marginal, profit is very marginal, to go to court every time. And if he doesn't withhold it, if the service station man is working for him, puts gas in his car and puts it on a slip or signs for it, or maybe he takes money from the cash register and signs for it, I think it would be very difficult for him to try and recover from a dishonest employee, and you know it would be. But it's not difficult for that poor employer who's getting by the skin of his teeth to be sued in the department, and your agency, by going in there and lifting a substantial sum from him on behalf of some employee. It seems to me it's a one-way street.
Well, and what's happening in businesses like that, again, through our efforts to assist employers and explain the law to them, and, is that we are recommending that you have the employee sign in with the amount, including the amount of money in the cash drawer. Employee signs out with the employer, indicating the amount of money in the cash drawer. And the employee has the sole access to the cash drawer during the shift. That is one way an employer is going to avoid the problem. In fact, we will take a claim like that from the employee, and if the employer has abided by this type of guideline, and we find that the cash shortage is attributable to that employee, then we do not consider that an illegal deduction. So we can look at the individual circumstances in that type of case.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Carson.
Well, let's pursue that, Mr. Wolf, with me. If I understand C properly, as long as the employee agrees to it ahead of time in writing, then the deduction can be made.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm a little troubled by the word lawful. What you're saying is that even if there is a signed statement, the employee says, okay, I'll take the job, and I understand if there's a shortage, you can take it out of, for any circumstances, there's a shortage, you can take it out of my pay. Employee agrees. You're saying now that unless there's a sign-in, sign-out by rule or by order, the Bureau of Labor has determined that is an unlawful agreement? I don't
know. No, that's what it is presently. We don't have this signed authorization in the law now. And so presently they're using that guideline. We do not think that the Bureau of Labor is actually the agency or the body that should examine issues of gross negligence or subject of that matter. We think that's probably for the courts.
Okay, what I'm worried about is lawful. I it's one thing if it's lawful, permitted by statute or not prohibited by statute, but I get a little concerned if lawful also means it violates the guidelines of some state agency, and therefore becomes unlawful. For instance, if we pass this, and the facilitation operator then has the signed authorization, reads the statute, and understands that he says fine, it would be a cruel twist of fate to have him then be hauled before a jail later, because the Bureau of Labor determines that even though he complied with the statute, he has not complied with the guidelines, and therefore the transaction is, quote, unlawful, unquote. So what I'm concerned about is if the employee and employer agree, then suppose the Bureau of Labor come in judging lawful and unlawful.
If there is such an agreement, and then the employer files a wage claim saying that this deduction was made, and we will look at the signed authorization. And if the employee has clearly authorized the deduction, then the claim will not be valid.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think that Senator Carson is still fingering a problem here. I go further than the lawful and say, purpose accruing to the benefit of the employee. What happens when the employee and the employer agree that to recover, say, $5 from the till that the employee E admits, oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I borrowed that. And the employer says, well, let me just deduct it. And the employee says, sure. Now, is that a benefit accruing to the benefit of the employee?
Well, actually, in this case, it did, because essentially the employee took a loan from the employer.
And what if that, I'm just wondering about a number of circumstances. I think that would be a...
We
discussed the
responsibilities, yes.
Okay. How about work uniforms? I assume that's also covered.
Yeah, that would be covered.
Yes, could you argue continued employment would be a benefit to the employees?
Yeah,
we're going to deduct it back to year three.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get a few more deal for it.
I don't really understand the steps to that point.
How broad or how narrow is the benefit of the employee? I'm trying to figure out now we're down to a guy that hires one person by this. I'm trying to figure out how he's going to weave his way to the mystery of state law and the rules and guidelines of the Bureau of Labor.
how broad is the benefit of the employee? And what I'm suggesting, perhaps facetiously, but I'm trying to get the breadth of what that means, is that if he has continued employment, a sufficient benefit.
I don't ask no.
Okay.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, John.
But, Mr. Chairman, I do, I'm sorry. I do have one for the question. How many people are we talking about? How many employers are we talking about that would now be covered by the statute that were not, if this were passed, that were not covered before? In other words, how many employers do we have in the state who has one or more but less than five employees, you know?
I do not know. I research people. We'll pull that together. We're trying to get a breakdown, either through the Employment Division or Commerce.
David, do you have that information for us before we take any action?
Yes, I will.
I'll use all these bills.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
here's a short one. This matter of having to go into court, if can't deduct from the check, is people almost always have some wages due, except right at the moment of the payday. Wouldn't it be the case that the check could be held? Would you take action, try and take action against an employer that held the check when someone was stealing from the till and put the burden on the dishonest employee to bring legal action to get that check?
Well, we have a payday law, one that I'm not all that familiar with myself, which requires individuals to be paid, I think, within 35 days, and you have, that's the widest margin you're given, and you're supposed to have regular paydays, and supposed to have the work week should be consistent. So if an employer who would withhold the check without due process or...
Without going to court.
Going to court, that would be considered an illegal deduction. We would require the employer, and I don't think that would be... I think under existing law, we would require the employer to produce the check. He's going to terminate the employee. It's unlikely that an employer is going to hold a check for an employee with it to continue in his
employment. I'm talking about somebody, he's stealing from the till and he's terminated and he's not given his last check.
Well, the law specifically says that if he's terminated without notice, he has to be paid immediately. The check has to be there.
Now, what would you do if the employee called you up and said they say I sold out of the till and they won't give me my last check? What would the Labor Department do?
Not normally,
they don't say admit to that.
No, I didn't say that I sold it. He would say I sold out of the till. I'm saying the employer says I sold out of the till. I've had clients come to me and say this.
We would advise the employer to pay the employee and then take the proper court action. I mean, in that case, actual theft, that's a criminal situation anyway, and we're not prepared to deal with those issues.
Well, that's what we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes, is somebody taking money out of the till and...
not intentionally. There are cash shortages.
Maybe we have been talking. You may not have, but my fellow senators here have been talking about that.
Well, most of them
you find that the employee is stealing from you, and then you say, well, you stole from me, but we'll consider it a loan, so we're going to deduct it. And I'm just trying to see if the employer is really helpless in that situation.
No, I don't think the employer is helpless at all.
Well, you're going to tell him to release the check.
We're going to tell him to release the check, but if he has reason to suspect that there's some actual theft involved, or if there's negligence, it's more often than not, it's negligence and incompetence is what results in cash shortages. Then we suggest to that employer to pay the check. You're not going to have any problem then with a wage claim. There's no problem with the wage claim. You're not going to be hassled by the Bureau of Labor.
Mm-hmm.
And then take the party to either a small claim court or go to the DA.
Why should the burden be on the employer to do that?
That's the burden on anyone who's the DA party to file an action.
Somebody steals from you and
then you're the burden is on the employee to bring the claim to us.
Yes, Robert.
Seems to me that there is a relationship too here between question of deducting from the employee's wages and the down payment. Perhaps some of the questions could.
You've got to go to court and get a judgment against somebody before you drive through their wages.
So this is essentially, is this a parallel approach?
Well, we're saying that the employer should not have to
be a court action before there's a
debt. Obviously, I don't see that. If he's suing the employer, the employer's going to have to take court action against this man and prove his point
right.
before he can.
Well, let me say it. Just tell him to say the same thing the other way, and that is that I don't think the wage claim or the DLA is the forum to determine criminal action.
Yeah.
I think that's
criminal.
That's
right. It is his department to determine whether it's criminal action or not.
It's the same concern I had about becoming lawful and unlawful in the language we have in here, which the DLA is going to become. That's the same stuff that I'm worried about, is that I'm wondering whether the DLA is the forum for determining what's a lawful deduction. That's the problem I'm having. I'd like to delete all line 24. I won't move it now. I'll let Mr. Walter
have
it.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, John. Next is Jack Cohn, asking ABC. And he's appearing just on two bills, 310 and 311.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Kalinowski. I represent the Associated General Contractors. Mr. Chairman, I brought with me Mr. A.J. Capobuno, who's our labor relations manager. I asked him to come down here because in reading these three bills, Bill 309, 310, and 311, I found them very difficult to understand, and in trying to not only understand them, but to see how they might be applicable to the construction industry, I asked for his counsel, and he is going to help me somewhat in this testimony. If you'll allow, Mr. Chairman, the first bill you heard this morning was Senate Bill 310, when we got into these three. I was not signed up to testify. Excuse me.
When you were signed up to testify on 310, you weren't on 309.
I beg your pardon. And I'd like to make a couple of comments about Senate Bill 309, if you'll allow.
On 309?
On 309, yes. Although I'm not signed up.
I think on 309, didn't we? There were no objections to the
I'd like to be recorded now as being opposed to the bill, Mr. Chairman. 309. Yes. Seems to me that this particular piece of legislation would open wide some doors for more litigation in the area of workman's compensation. And I'd like to point out that what we're talking about here in a great many cases is a lawsuit against an employer, even though the employer may not have any fault or any involvement in the discrimination at all. If you'll take any person of any minority characteristics or any person who has any unusual physical characteristics, And we normally, among men, make jokes about women's extraordinary physical characteristics, and I think we would all admit to that.
I wouldn't.
Hold on. I said, we Polish people might favor this bill, Mr. Chairman. But I think that what would happen with this is we would end up with a great deal of litigation against employers that is truly unwarranted but allowed under the statute. In the event you do enact the bill, however, I would hope that that you would give some consideration to avoid the double damages instance, so that a workman's compensation carrier, if he has paid for such psychiatric care that resulted from this, would have first lien on any damages that would be paid to the plaintiff. That's all I really wanted to say on Senate Bill 309, Mr. Chairman. If there are any questions on that, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Any questions? Yeah, one of the concerns that I had in this area is to have the workman's comp law block the civil rights proceedings. And I think that's Mr. Wolf's concern, is that when the workman has the choice of going into a workman's comp claim or going after civil rights, can you think of any way we could set the bill up so that if they did make a workers' comp claim, they would not be precluded from their civil rights action?
I think that's what that bill does, Senator.
It does a lot more than that, I think.
Yeah, I think it
doubles up is what I'm asking. Of course, I think in my own judgment, it's an example of the workers' comp latitude where harassment becomes a compensable injury.
just the furthering what has happened. I think his workers' comp now is not only a retirement program and a Medicare program, but it apparently is also a civil rights program. I think that's a concern, but I don't, that's the court problem. I don't know we can get to it.
Well, I don't know whether you heard my testimony originally on this particular bill just a few moments ago. Maybe you didn't, but what I was suggesting was that in order to solve this problem, if an injured person who's been injured by harassment has received medical care, lost time benefits, and perhaps some type of permanent partial disability benefits as a result of this action, this harassment, if you will, by fellow employees, then turns around and sues the employer under a civil rights, this civil rights.
Yeah, I heard that, and I know it's
then I would think then any damages that would accrue to the claimant should be paid to the...
So if we made that amendment, you'd be satisfied with it?
No, but I think that amendment ought to be in there if you pass the bill.
I see.
I need
to pass the bill.
I
see. Okay.
Okay,
well,
I think that's...
Senate Bill 310, we're signed up in favor of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Well, you're right on the line. You can't tell you're in favor. I thought you were sort of straddling the fence.
We are kind of straddling the fence. One of the reasons for that, Mr. Chairman, is if you take the first sentence of the bill and read it, it's grammatically incorrect. What the draft of the bill has done is deleted part of a phrase, which makes the bill grammatically incorrect, and then in turn makes it a little bit difficult to fully understand. If we understand the motive of the supporter of the bill, we think it's somewhat admirable. Here's where Mr. Casabruno is going to help me. But we do have problems.
Isn't that what we've been talking about, getting that injured workman back on the job, and this is what we've been talking about, and I wonder if this bill wouldn't help us accomplish
that. Well, it would help, because we would not be required to give him his former job if that job has been filled, but we could give him a job that is similar. What we're worried about, Mr. Chairman, not only with this bill, but the existing law, is that we do get involved in conflicts with our labor union agreements, and here's where Mr. Castellano can help.
Thank you. Just as mentioned, on the surface at least, the bill seems to give a bit more flexibility to the employer in terms of using language such as the same or similar versus a more specific than his former physician. We, in construction industry, are pretty heavily organized, and in our case, we represent over 400 general contractors and over 1,000 real estate, and it's only between 40,000 and 50,000 construction employees. And for the most part, almost all of the contractors, be they general contractors or subcontractors, like the mechanical and electrical, labor under hiring hall provisions. And for all intents and purposes, they are exclusive hiring halls in which we have to go, and we don't have any choice about it, we have to go directly to the union every time we need a man for a particular job. So that in a particular case of someone being terminated or laid off because of an injury and then coming back in a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, we have a definite conflict in our collective bargaining agreements with the unions, since this man has not then come back to the hiring hall, has not been properly dispatched. The construction industry is a very, as you can well imagine, transient type, temporary industry, if you will. Job lasts anywhere from a couple of days to a couple of weeks. It's not a permanent situation where you would have in the industrial manufacturing setting. So that in a lot of cases, these people may come back and their job has literally been terminated. That phase of the work is over. So that he would have to, if you will, and he'd have to be a member of the union to begin with, have to go back to the hiring hall. What this provision seems to do is if you were to short circuit or circumvent our contractual obligations with these unions.
Now, granted, not everybody is organized, but in our particular industry, quite a bit of it is organized, and quite a bit of the other industries are likewise organized. Now, they may not have these exclusive hiring halls as we do, but nevertheless, they also have similar problems, and I'd like to just bring out another problem. So you're talking about giving somebody the same or similar position. Although that sounds, on the surface, it doesn't sound all that bad, it gets us into another set of problems in the construction industry. And that is, our industry is an industry that's plagued by jurisdictional disputes. Each and every union, there's some 18 to 20 different unions, and generally they're all on the construction side at the same time, maintain very cautiously, they guard their jurisdiction. You can't touch anything that's round and feels cold and is metal without the plumber getting involved. And if it's wood, you can be damn sure that the carpenter is going to lay claim to it. So we're in a situation where jurisdiction is very defined and highly guarded. And in a situation where a worker is injured, he may perhaps have been a laborer, or he may have been an operating engineer, and he comes back and his injury is such that he can no longer be a laborer, he no longer can be an operating engineer, but perhaps he can drive a pickup truck, or perhaps he can do some pizza work. Perhaps he can be put in a warehouse doing some pizza work. Well, immediately you see our problem, that this guy who was a laborer has now all of a sudden become a teamster, designated by, as such, by the employer, not by the union. And we would just have one heck of a problem in making this guy who was formerly a member of one craft and putting him to work as a member of another craft, regardless of how laudable our motives may be. The unions have a definite job in this area, and they police it and they enforce it, and that is that they guard their jurisdiction. So although this doesn't sound terribly bad on the surface, it really in our industry is going to cause a considerable amount of labor management conflicts, if you will.
Mr. Chairman, just at some point, I wonder if we could have Mr. Wolf respond to the two points the gentleman was making, one about hiring hall provisions, the other about jurisdictional disputes that might arise.
Yes, have you taken into consideration drafting this bill? It doesn't appear to be. We don't appear to be.
4-0 is designed for the purpose of reemployment shall be subject to the provisions for seniority rights and other employment restrictions contained in a valid collective bargaining agreement between the employer and a representative of his employees.
Would that handle your situation, counsel?
Seniority rights?
Well, the in a sense, there are no seniority rights, but the second part of that law, as read, I would think would go away to him any kind of concerns that he has.
I guess I'm not clear. 6594 is second law. And are you saying that the proposed change is going to bring all this government into the construction industry, or the present law does?
I'm saying that this new law as proposed poses a very strong potential conflict for the two reasons that I outlined.
By substituting same for former,
that's correct.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I'm dense. Would somebody tell us, Jeff, can you run it by my head again?
Well,
I apologize to the witness. I just don't understand how that visit.
I think I understand, Senator, that we have problems with the existing statute. We do have a problem with the existing statute. This bill starts to help solve our problem. But if what Mr. Castlebrenner is saying is if we have an operating engineer injured on the job, and then the operating engineer wants to come back to work. Now, we've already got somebody else out of the hiring hall to work on that job.
Mm-hmm.
Now he wants to come back, and that particular operating engineer's job is no longer available on the construction site. It's, that portion of the job is over. Where are we going to put him?
Okay, but that's part of law. They're going to get you facing that today, aren't you?
Yes, we're facing that today, but if we're required by the new legislation to give him the same or similar job, we don't have anything to give him.
But don't the word which is available, is retaining, I apologize, I'm really wrong.
I can understand, Senator, and it's a difficult thing for us to try to explain. The which is available thing, a phrase that you're referring to, is in that first sentence, which is grammatically incorrect, and I don't understand what it's intended to mean, and it's very difficult for me to convey that to you and the rest of the committee.
Well, let's suppose it says, it is a bad sentence, it's a complex sentence, obviously done by somebody in the legal profession. If it were to operate this way, that a workman, and when I'm talking about a person who has been disabled and can't come back to do the same work, that's as Mr. Wolf has pointed out in a different section. So we're talking about the he's broken a leg and now it's mended his back and he can do the same job. Okay, if I understand present law and this law is that he must give him back the same job or his former position of employment, or you give him a similar position if they're available. Now, if the law were to work that way, would you have any objection to it? In other words, the operating engineer is running a lift, but he's hurt, he goes off the job, they hire a new man, and he has one position for it, he comes back and stands sorry.
What does similar mean? Now, we have operating engineers who operate the power trains on the Capitol Wing construction. We also had an operating engineer operating a self-service elevator for employees going up and down, the contractor's employees going up and down. Now, is that similar? That's within that same craft.
It was two extremes,
and I used them purposely.
That would,
I think that's a beautiful example because it fits right into the discussion we're having because that would also probably fit within 420. The other agreement, the such right of reemployment shall be subject to the provisions for seniority and other employment restrictions contained in the valid collective bargaining agreement. Now, if the collective bargaining agreement between the state and the union operating engineers allowed it, the man could be moved or woman from the crane to the elevator. And that wouldn't cause a jurisdictional dispute between the unions. Isn't that right?
Would you interpret?
I hope so, Senator.
Well, what
would you interpret that to mean that that if we were to take this fellow who had been injured and we put him on the elevator, operating the self-service elevator?
It means we
have to discharge the fellow who has been operating that elevator.
Well, it says that the existing law and the amendment wouldn't change it as available.
So,
your interpretation now is that under present law, you would have to fire the person running the elevator and put this person, the injured person back on.
I think so. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
What has forced you to that interpretation with the words which is available being in this present statute?
Has the labor shall be reinstated by his employer to his former position of employment.
Why would it be so difficult to get his job back? A man has worked for you for years, he breaks a leg, he's back, and he's just going back to work.
Senator, would
you have trouble in the union?
Mr. Chairman, the question is, would we have to fire the fellow that we hired to replace him?
I would think so, and the answer is yes. Well, if you lay him off, and this man's entitled to a job, that's common, I think, for a person to have a replacement in the job market, and when he gets sick or death in the family or whatever, he can get a day off, a few days off, a week off, someone replaces him.
I wasn't suggesting that.
His job should be available to him when he's ready to return. I mean, what's wrong with this?
I fear I misled you. I didn't say there was anything wrong with it. I was trying to respond to Senator Wire's question and as to what seniority rights really meant. And I think this means that
in answer to his question, that we would have to fire, or lay off, if you will, the fellow who had been hired to take his place while he was recovering from his injury.
Why don't you do this, and if you meet with Mr. Wolf and see if you can flesh this out, and come back at the next meeting, and it'll be very helpful, I think, to the committee.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than...
Yeah. On Senate Bill 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After this last question, I hate to bring up labor use the complexities, but as an aside on Senate Bill 311, somebody mentioned the $5 out of the till as borrowing. That's borrowing small tools, and the construction business is a major problem. The only comment I'd like to make on that is that we would really hate like hell to have you place us in a position where we have to take anybody who borrows our small tools to court, to small claims court, to try to get the money back. If we can tell the fellow who borrowed the tools and doesn't plan to return them, okay, I'll just deduct it from your paycheck, and he says, okay, then fine. That's an amiable way of getting around this thing without having him happen to sign an agreement, and scaring the hell out of him.
You started out talking about taking small tools. I got the feeling that we were together, that stealing is something that we can't tolerate. And then you go into saying, rather than taking it to court, we should be able to just make an agreement and go on. Now, aren't those two inconsistent with each other? If we're going to have employees that steal from us, and we're going to know they're stealing from us, and we're just going to write little agreements and get the money back, where's this going to end?
Well, it depends on on how much the fraud or theft, I guess it is, really amounts to. But if somebody walks off with a set of socket wrenches, an employer finds out about it, and he can sit down and talk to that employee and say, hey, I know you took those, and the guy says, all right, I did, but I sold them, to somebody else. Well, isn't it reasonable for that employer to work something out with that employee where he can repay it by deducting from his paycheck in the hope that the guy will not do it again? And then, if he refuses to go along with that kind of thing, then bring him into small claims court or whatever it is to recover the money. All I'm saying is, Senator, is I hope you don't put us in a position with this bill of
forcing us to take legal action against every kind of theft that there might be.
Well, would this provision of a written agreement cause you problems?
Well, if a written agreement is the only way of going about it, it could. A lot of our contractors are small contractors, and they might have 5, 8, or 10 employees, you know, and they've got a real good working relationship with their employees, and I don't think a lot of times just for personal purposes, they want to take the guy to court. They can work something out with him fine, but without having to sign an agreement.
Okay. Go ahead,
Robert. Well, it would seem that it would be to the benefit of both to have a written agreement, as long as this the suggestion of, I believe it was Senator Carson, followed amending the laws. Amending the bill would take out line 24 for a lawful purpose accruing against an employee, and simply putting a period after the first line would allow the employer to make a number of deductions as long as the employee simply agreed to those deductions and there was a sound authorization. Wouldn't that seem to? Because obviously, if the alternative was known to the employee, that they would be taken to court or they would lose their job, it seems that would solve a problem. And the employee could. Otherwise, I think it is true that the employee, as well as the employer, would suffer because the employee would then, the employee would be forced either to pay up right immediately in cash or in the position of, or that the employer would be forced to take to court without that alternative being available to the employee.
It may work very well, Senator, but
there's
a formality that oftentimes is not necessary.
So you don't feel that you need a court, a written agreement even in that case as a requirement?
I wouldn't really object to it, but I want you to know the effect of it.
Well, I might be allowed to just make a statement. I think we would feel a lot comfortable with that line 24 deleted, I believe it is. But it is very difficult for people who are educated in a foreign manner to understand about the construction industry. The people in this industry are extremely bright, but for the most part uneducated in terms of a formal education. And they find it extremely difficult to put anything down in writing. And we are lucky that we have written collective bargaining agreements. My employer would probably say unlucky, but it's just terribly difficult to get anybody to sign a grievance or a dispatch slip or anything that requires any kind of signature or a two-sentence statement like, I agree that you can be deaf, if you will. And I think perhaps that's what you were getting at, Jack, and you were a little hesitant about having a certain formality.
There's
one thing that concerns me, Jack. It sounds like maybe the construction industry is one way of solving this problem, but I certainly hope the tools never amount to over $200, because there's a crime called compounding a felony at 162.335. It says a person commits the crime of compounding, if he accepts or agrees to accept any pecuniary benefit, his consideration for refraining from reporting to law enforcement authorities the commission or suspected commission of any felony or information relating to a felony. I hope that if that practice is under $200, which is the limit for felony, or many of your employers, while they think they're doing their employee a good turn, are committing a crime.
The only problem with that is we deal in volume. In other words, we may have in the course of a day 100 screwdrivers missing, and that's 100 people ripping off perhaps 100 screwdrivers. So you're absolutely right, but each individual theft, if you will, is somewhat of a petty theft, but in the aggregate, it really amounts to a whole lot.
Senator, I'd like to assure you that I'll copy that statute and send it out in the next bulletin we send to our members what compounding a felony is, but I can't assure you that I'll do it.
It's a little known statute.
Little known statute, yes.
Mr. Chairman,
there is a relatively serious concern we have about this bill that I did want to mention to you. In the complexities of the labor union agreements that we have with our labor unions, it's very easy to overpay an employee. I'd like, if you'll allow Mr. Castelbruno to briefly address that issue.
I'm sure in the future you're really going to think we have problems in the future here. The construction industry, as large as it is, has about as many unique problems unto itself, and we are one of the largest employers in the state, and we employ a good number of people. The nature of the work is short-term, get in and get out, with as few scars as possible, if you will. And that, those scars mean lots of things. The bookkeepers who write these checks to the various construction employees are under a tremendous amount of pressure. And there is a reason for this. You know, in the apprenticeship program, they often tell me that they teach two cardinal rules, and one is that water runs downstream, and layoff is payoff. So we're in a situation here where the people are not paid, for example, on every Friday, like in a manufacturing industrial setting. They are not paid the same amount every week. They are not putting in 40 hours per week, so that the bookkeeper knows that everybody makes $261.20 every week. They work a lot of overtime. Everyone's check differs. We have upwards of 20 classifications, perhaps, for each individual collective bargaining agreement. So that the myriad of problems that are posed in the bookkeeping area is just one hell of a nightmare. Mistakes are bound to happen, mistakes do happen, and mistakes happen with a good deal of frequency, regardless of our own enforcement and measures to correct those particular mistake situations. As I see this bill here in front of us, it makes no provision for an employer to deduct from a man's check after he suddenly become aware of the fact that he has overpaid or mistakenly paid or mistakenly deducted something. And this happens day in and day out where somebody has paid an extra hour of overtime or an extra 2 hours of stay time or has paid an extra fringe benefit that he was not entitled to. The easiest thing to do is to just deduct it in a very reasonable manner over the next week or two that the employee works. Of course, if the employee leaves the job, then the most intensive purpose of the employer is without any remedy, really. This is what, we don't have any objections outside of the ones we raised to this bill, except we think it ought to be added that mistakes and erroneous payments we ought to be able to recoup by deductions.
Senator,
go. Which one is Mr. Wolf? What would respond to that?
Okay, what do you have to do? What if he overpays, what if the contractor overpays a man, can the contractor legally, under the terms of this bill, and if this bill is enacted, and plus existing law, can he just automatically deduct that from his wages the following payday?
I believe I'm interpreting the law, yes.
Without even notice to the employer?
Yes, we're talking about deductions that are not...
To the employer, without notice to the employee.
Right, yeah.
I don't believe the bill reads that way, Mr. Chairman.
You indicated there was existing law that would take care of that, right?
I don't think the labor commissioner can have a practice that's in conflict with the law.
That's right.
If this bill is enacted.
We may not be communicating directly. But when you fire an employer to pay their due wage, and then they're told. That employer is still, by the withholding, is retaining the pay in a good way. The total wages for that employee will be the same for that month or be collected. We do not have a valid wage claim if the employee came in and said,
okay.
Would the act change that much?
I'll
have to look at that.
I think I would, Mr. Chairman.
I want to get together with him on that, too, and see if we can put that
I
just want to know, Mr. Chairman, we're delighted to share some of our experiences and enlighten the
community.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
employment temporary.
Bob Kennedy, did you want to speak on 210?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman McGraw. Committee, I did not sign up, but after I find the questions that have arisen on 310, well, I did want to make a few responses to that. I see that there's a good deal, and from both sides, because I've seen situations, for instance, where a person has been returned to a manufacturing plant where they had four punch tests. And so the fellow was working on the one on the end, and when he comes back to work, well, there's somebody else there, and so someone else is terminated on one of the other three, and they put him over there. And he's used to Old Bessie, and he wants to work on that one. Anyway, that's what he's named. Well, it's really nitpicking, and there's no difference in his size. The working conditions are the same and everything else. So looking at it from an employer standpoint, I can see where it saves some of this type of situation. Moving over to address the point that Senator Junstad raised, the question about the one employee employer. We had, I had quite a number of experiences representing employers with small numbers of employees. And the thing that I found, you find sometimes that an employer does not want to re-employ a person. And the way the present language is, why, I said, now look, I don't have to take you back, and what has happened, he goes and changes his job, just adds some little thing. Well, in fact, the duties are, but it's so minute that anybody could still, the person could still do it. But the fact is, by law, he can escape. So that's one of the biggest reasons that the Oregon FLCL supports that. And not only that, sometimes, and there can be various reasons, there are some employers that they want to see a person send in injured, and I think that this person might be a risk, so anything I can do to avoid taking him back gets into this. And also, then when you get into an area, for instance, where it only happens to be one person, for instance, if this employer has, or employee has built up quite a number of fringe benefits, so we say vacation scheduling, usually that over the longer you've been there, the more you accrue, other types of benefits of which might be on seniority. And so if he can eliminate this person, saves himself some money. So anyway, on that basis, he's important.
Thank you,
Bob. I want to ask a question, and maybe I'm stupid. I'm a small town distributor of anything. I do the office work myself, and I have three employees, three different routes. One of them is injured, and I replace him. 18 months later, the fellow that's injured comes back. Under this law, if it's adopted, would I have to bump one of my three drivers? You would bump the one that was hired to replace him when he went off. Well, when you hired somebody, the person should have been notified that you have a person that's been injured. And so he's really on notice that's the duration of his employment.
Okay, I can bump somebody.
I wouldn't say that. So they don't become permanently and totally disabled.
I think it's very important to that.
Are there further questions? If not, the committee stands adjourned.